Well, these little amendments to that, so we cover all things up. The previous vote. We did the same because the committee came out, we used to have decided on it before you came. And also because you are, as you said, that very slow as you mind, you will mind it. Right. So basically, the any amendments were made yesterday, the other amendments were protested by peers and supplementary, right? So we therefore are going to move to the very speed. Because the supplementary protests everything else apart from the content. So Frank, you can get to the system, right? Then you also were given away last night copies of the report. I don't know if you have them here with you. I don't have any copies of the report.
Amendment of paragraph 43 of the 8th schedule of expropriation of 1964. Very well. I said, what I know? He's also looking at the rest of the product. Yeah, but you see, So and chair, that's the media campaign before. And obviously, as the the sort of actual impact that people feel, as I said, on the text itself, the digitization really will not be found for a long, long time. And people need to assure the one, the fund of state, two, government not even touching the cent of that money, it's still under the control of their trustees. Of course, there are issues of governance over the trustees and so on. And so that's why, in addition to that, I think just to be clear, and some of our lecture here, but to just outline that there's a number of other steps that we will be taking to make potential actions. So first is the communication, and in that we highlight the special, we highlight and try and get others, opinions and trustees to join us in spreading on the message, emphasizing that the property remains that of the workers. I think there's a whole lot of related issues which, in the main, with the focus on this, that we have mentioned to Parliament before, but just to show you where it is in, that Chile is in the process of trying to significantly reform the system. The moment we see, for example, can only be done by ensuring something. We want to ensure that it's better and more appropriate communities, and those came out in the end family building communities, but it may well be that in certain markets building communities may be more appropriate because people are raising concerns. What if I don't know this community? Will I be able to pass it on to my beneficiaries if I die soon after retiring? I think we want to actually, we do have a process of what we call default regulations to also get funds. Take more responsibility for members as they retire or exit. Because at the moment, someone retires, the funds actually just pay you your money and say, bye-bye. Now let's take responsibility to make sure that appropriate communities that they made available. And we also want to though this act doesn't deal with translation, we want to put out paper because certain Australians are not taking a hard line on 100% translation. There are issues that we hear about what happens if workers are exchanged, unemployed, etc. And then, of course, there's a set of complementary measures. First is to continue engaging in that sense. Secondly,
the big question that I said is, So llegar a casa. No, es que me dio como una muerte interior. I'm getting paid. Not for me. So then the email thing, I think it gave the two in the last week, because I had sent one of my email the other day with my laptop during the, and I think it was the same thing with my phone from the last time. So I tried to send them the documents and other days, and like, did it okay, now I keep talking about. So they told me before that when they have slow sharing in Korea, or it affects the state of the world, but I thought I was safe.
Yeah.
But I think it's something to do with them, say like, because I have quite a lot of makeup time.
Thank you.
That these again are words that should come from national treasury. Oh, granted. would like to suggest a wondering bonus for Alex. Can you write to the design? Since Alex not yet and Peter Paul is not yet, write a letter to the translator. And you can give us a chance to say okay, you want to figure the name? Good.
And share with you another question.
Yeah, very good, very good.
Directly affected by these amendments. Nor has there been any assessment
the impact that these policies of tariffs both may have on the financial market specifically and the South African economy in general. So, even the list of time, I want to focus this committee's attention on
you knew something was earlier than planned to do. You had identified it.
Can you just agree on this? 15 minutes.
Maximum 20 minutes.
So there are three major issues left. The proposal of this policy for asking the legislature to approve. I want you to do it each and every one individually. First, summarizing everything on this, I'll take the practical implications of this policy. The first issue I'll increasingly to strike up again, I'll again preliminarily, in adopting this goal, is to take away ASDP's status as a central counterparty. In certain provinces, JSP is currently licensed as a central counterparty in Kerryas, in accordance with the provisions of the Financial Market Act, and as it has been since the inception of SAFCOM as it was previously known in 1998. Just briefly, a central counterparty is a very important infrastructure in the financial market, especially in the derivatives market, that serves to minimize the risk and manage risk of market participants. Now, JSEP or SAFCOM, as it was previously known, has always acted as a central counterparty since 1998. And in addition, it currently meets international criteria as a qualifying central counterparty.
What's the problem?
It is, you need to find yourself between buyers and sellers in a derivatives market. You take away the risk and manage the risk, financial risk and financial risk. The G20 recommendations for the financial crisis and the CDPs. And to a large extent limited those risks, and of course the JSEP was a central counterpart to the South Africa, insulated completely from the financial crisis in 2008. This is a very simple practical example. Lehman Brothers was a market participant on JSEP and JSEP. It was the largest participant, yet the market funds were smoothly. Lehman Brothers' positions were paid out. There were no disruptions, any risk posed by the invasion of Lehman Brothers. We'll go to this point later, which was an international player. Yet the law now says, because JSEP is an associated carrier out scheme, it doesn't have its own building members, it relies on the JSEP's rules to regulate its own animals, JSEP will not be a counterpart anymore. Now, this was not a choice made by JSEP to have an associated territory.
Can I alert all of us? I'm not going to take this with you. This is all you know that's happening. I think every 5 minutes,
where the counterparty is what happens with the existing act, he says, you're only allowed to be a counterparty if you are an independent carrier. So actually being an associated carrier, you need to clear the sort of action to the JSC rules. This was not a shortcut chosen by JCP. This was informed by the existing statutory and legislative structure, and I'll make mention of this in my presentation, since 1988. Therefore, we were forced to structure our business in this manner because it was the only way that insolvency protection followed on transactions concluded on the entities markets. So my point first would be that JCP is a central counterparty. JCP has been a central counterparty since 1988. It is an associated clearinghouse, a central counterparty, in terms of statute since 1988 and its successors. And now, by the stroke of the pen, perversity, this bill will take away JCP's status as a CCP, with the loss responsibility for the market. So this is the first principal issue that Parliament has asked policy change, that Parliament is the second critical matter of importance is another the amendment of another internationally recognized and accepted cornerstone of financial market legislation, both in South Africa and in international jurisdictions, it being the peremptory requirement that if you conduct business or fulfill functions within the jurisdiction of South Africa as a financial market infrastructure, you have to be licensed before you are allowed to do so. Let's use an example. Capitec Bank is a deposit-taking institution in a bank. Take deposits from the clients and the man on the street, they have their banking license. An international bank comes into South Africa, conducts business with South African customers, it accepts deposits from South Africans, this international entity must have a license as a bank is what's allowed to do so. From this JSC is an exchange, it needs a license to conduct business as an exchange. If JSC goes to London or another jurisdiction, it must apply for a license there, before it is going to constitute that jurisdiction. Yet this act says, only for international central counterparties, you will be exempted from applying for the license. You don't have to apply for a license. Your local clearinghouses, so if they are competitive to the JSC clear, they also establish a CCP, they have to comply with all the regulatory requirements of licensing and apply for a license. The London clearinghouse or another agency comes from abroad, they may exempt from applying for license. That's a second drastic change of policy that is forefront. Thirdly, it contemplates the removal of the director of market abuse, an independent institution that has been instrumental in combating financial crime and market abuse in South Africa, and that has ensured that South Africa remains the best or second best regulated market in the last couple of years. That is also contemplated in terms of this law. Now, fourthly, at the point of view, not only is Parliament asked to approve the amendment of these existing and well-established policies and principles, but asked to do so in absence of any meaningful form of consultation, or of being informed of the potential implications and consequences that these policy changes may result in. The consultation is not only important for market participants and infrastructure directly affected by these changes, but also to ensure that the legislature is able to have a full and comprehensive view of all relevant matters before it makes important decision of changing these two policy decisions. Now, we have made extensive written submissions on this, and I don't intend to repeat it. I just want to highlight certain matters of critical importance in respect of each example. Firstly, in terms of the removal of JSC, it is stated as the special counterparty. The Treasury response document to the official amendments refers to the national standards, recognitions, and recommendations to the South African G20 peer review, to the International Monetary Fund's financial segregation program.
Is that effectively is currently life in the Central Camp Party. And the National Treasury's response to certain of the amendments of migration to the G20 and the financial sector assessment program referred firstly to the lack of cooperation between regulators, secondly to the need for better regulation of unlisted foreigners. These issues are completely outside the sphere of the JCJ and duties and functions, and not one recommendation was made to JC or JCC.
I remember we asked you the 15th. There's two more votes, so it'll probably be, and then we're going to be gone.
So these recommendations make no reference to the fact that JCP and associated theory are supported in China and independent theory. On the contrary, as we said here, and if you read through this recommendation that we need to comply with the national standards, and that legislation has to be passed to ensure that, as we said here, the ACP is a qualified Central Council Party, recognised and accredited by the Ministry of Payment and Technical Assistance, CPSS, and also the National Organisation for Securities Commission. In addition to, South Africa has just been recognised by the European Commission's Securities and Market Department, EMA, as an equivalent jurisdiction, and we are on the final stages of qualifying as the Central Council Party for the European jurisdiction as well. Therefore, without passing this vote, JDP is already internationally recognized, compliant, CCP has complied with stringent international requirements, and we suggest that these consequential amendments are necessary to ensure that South Africa meets international standards in respect of JDP is one of the most. What these amendments will have to do is it will immediately remove JCP as status as Central Council Party, and that includes JCP and not to meet these requirements. Not its status as associated with the Kenyan period, but the promulgation of this law. Once again, no consultation on this important issue. The second important issue that I want to touch on is the introduction of an exemption from licensing that's only available to foreign companies that wish to conduct business in South Africa as a Central Council Party. This firstly offends against the rule of law, which is one of the cornerstones of our constitution and to democracy. This state that any statute must be equally applicable to all persons within the borders of South Africa. The proposed introduction of Section 49, capital A and B, is contrary to this principle and is asking Parliament and the legislature permission to adopt a policy that requires South African entities such as JCP or its competitors and tax agency, CCP, to employ staff, to have a local presence, and to meet all the statutory requirements of the CCP. For example, to ensure that there are funds available in South Africa to meet these obligations. But in the same breath, it asks the legislature to agree that a foreign company that wants to conduct the exact same business will be exempted from these requirements. This not only contrary to the rule of law and our constitution, but in conflict and even reconcilable with important policy objectives of the financial sector regulation and the Financial Markets Act. It will also create two-tiered regulation for the exact same functions and duties that will be performed in South Africa. Not only are you asked to approve these unlevel playing fields, you're also asked to approve a policy that will allow a foreign company that acts as a CCP South Africa to conduct business in South Africa in the absence of any form of regulatory oversight by the South African authorities, and you are asked to allow a permitted situation with South African regulatory authorities and abdicated the responsibilities to foreign regulators. This will have disastrous consequences for South Africa. If I go back to the Lehman's example, if, for example, Lehman's clear transactions in South African securities to an international CCP, its collateral and funds would no doubt have been swallowed by the crisis in London and Europe, because its collateral is held in a different basis in foreign jurisdiction. Its collateral is not within the borders of South Africa. It's the clearing out in South Africa and all the regulators have no control over those factors. So the second very important amendment of existing policy is a request from Parliament to agree to a situation where a foreign entity that conducts business in South Africa, the same business as South Africans, is without license. Thirdly, you are asked to acknowledge the Director of Market Abuse that has been instrumental the successful combat of financial crime in South Africa. I will not do these with a lack of spot directly to all the news, but I urge you to read paragraph 5 of our submissions in detail, where we set out why the provisions of market use in the new bill is not appropriate for the successful regulation in combat for financial crime. Possibly, my last point of principle, you are not only asked to approve substantive and far-reaching policy changes in circumstances we are facing. So we are asked to approve these policies in the absence of any form of meaningful consultation. And I just want to make some very good points about that, because I've seen there has been some responses in the Treasury document. The bill of December 2014 and of October 2015 are markedly different in any material aspects, including the matters that I've mentioned today. You can see from Treasury's response that they are taking to suggest that there have been discussions, meetings, and exchange of correspondence about certain matters that are encapsulated in this bill, and that there is sufficient consultation on these issues. I urge you not to be seduced by this line of reasoning. Yet there has been meetings, there has been consultations, there has been telephone calls and discussions, but not in the context of the bill before you. These were interactions limited to comments and concerns about the proposed draft regulations, promulgated to the Financial Markets Act that was initially published in 2014. Just to remind ourselves what regulations are intended to be, practical implementation of existing policy. It's not about management policy. Thank you. So, very similarly, the Minister of Finance may make regulations in terms of Section 97 to implement certain policies embodied in the Financial Markets Act, and it's for this reason that the OBC regulations were published. It was published for the Minister of Finance to regulate matters such as the OBC markets. This is perfectly within the bounds of the Minister's powers. It promulgates regulations that practically implement policy of the subordinate statute. Yes. However, the regulations published and comments that we make on regulations cannot be seen to be consultation on the bill. Any comment that we made or suggestion we made within the regulations, there cannot be a suggestion that. That's what it is said. We have published regulations. You have commented on those regulations. You have said that we are not allowed to change policy with regulations. We have now more or less included the context of those regulations in the statute. Your comments on the regulations must suffice to be comments on the statute. You are not allowed to make any further submissions. This bill is going to Parliament, make your submissions to Parliament. This is what happened in August. I can tell you that can never be seen to be sufficient consultation. Comments on subordinate legislation or proposed regulations are not comments on statute, and we have been denied the opportunity to make those comments. Those are my questions.
Okay, what was in to the Free Market Foundation? I'm sorry about the particularly, right? So obviously this is the made for take delay, for example. No, it's short, sharp, take delay. The shortest speech is maybe 24 minutes, right? So this is another word. Can I just ask any questions? I'm trying to do in the back. Do you mind? Can you answer like COVID and COVID?
Yeah.
So those two seats now are going to move in faster. Yeah, okay, you're taking these two. That's fine. Let's go, please. Thank you.
Right, so it's a 3 months from this. Thank you. 15 minutes, I think.
Good day to the Chair and Honourable Members of Parliament. My first part is to present. My name is Henry Longchomo. I'm with my colleague here, Leon Lowe. And what I'm going to do is, well, let me just explain a bit about the Freeman Foundation. Freeman Foundation is one of the main parties advocates free market policy. Political non-partisan, and I need not say any more. But let me just explain something about the way this works on the ground when it comes to commenting on the proposed policy bills And not least, we tend not to focus on the technical aspect, forcing the team and forcing the eyes and making, proposing, moderating for such changes to make. If we feel very strongly that the bill has to be sent back to the architects of the bill or has to be trapped, we state that quite openly, not without any arrogance. And that comes from just being honest and straight to the point. Now, our policies, our comments on all proposed policies focus largely primarily on the consumers. And sometimes we tend to forget about the very important players in the big broader scheme of things. But coming to this bill here, we feel that this bill has far-reaching implications, very far-reaching implications. And what I'm saying is we need to be conscious of the fact that if we're talking about the financial services sector, we're talking about the lifeline of the economy. So any policies that are proposed have to be considered very, 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 very carefully. And it is our view that there hasn't been sufficient consultation with affected parties, and especially also the consumer groups. And we would urge the committee to apply its mind to that. And we feel that this bill has to be sent back in order to be subjected to a very rigorous social economic impact assessment. This is of fundamental importance. This point is accentuated by what is contained in the document of the National Treasury, that's the title of National Treasury Policy Document of 2011. And let me quote from that. It's headline, "A Safer Financial Sector to Serve South Africa Better." I quote from the document, "The financial services sector is at the heart of the South African economy and touches the life of each and every citizen. Financial services allow people to make daily economic transactions, save and preserve wealth to meet future aspirations and retirement needs, and insure against personal disaster. At the level of the macroeconomy, the financial sector enables economic growth, job creation, the building of vital infrastructure, and sustainable development for South Africa and many people." Now, it seems to me, perusing the bill, that this has not been taken seriously in the sense of chair, right, to impress that on everyone. And so we urge very, very, very emphatically that this bill should be subjected to a rigorous, let me repeat my words, a rigorous socio-economic assessment. It's a crucial point, especially given the fact that at this point in time, if we're talking about the economic growth rate of our country, we're talking about being the negative. And at this point, I'm going to hand over to Leon. Leon will dwell on the impact assessment of view that we're very familiar about, and he is, of course, our internal expert, and he's also largely recognized as an expert in this field globally. So I hand over the reins to Leon, and we'll deal with the demonstration.
Chair and members of the committee, in the interest of expedition, I'm not going to have any formalities, just get straight into it. Yes, it is, I think, anomalous that the DTI is here. I've just spoken to their representative present. We were consulted by them on the introduction of regulatory impact assessments, as they were then called, as long as 10 years ago. The Treasury then took over that responsibility. We had consultations with them. Cabinet then decided that this should be introduced, and then it was taken over by the presidency, which 3 years ago published very comprehensive guidelines for how regulatory impact assessment should be conducted. And Minister Nene, this very department's own minister, said in his medium-term budget speech that socio-economic impact assessments, as he called them, have already been introduced in our government policy. So it's quite anomalous to us that his own staff are presenting bills to Parliament that seem to ignore what their own minister has said all proposed measures, especially ones of this gravitas, should be subjected to. I happened at the time with the DTI to have travelled all over the world on their behalf and in collaborating with them, and studied how impact assessments are done in about a dozen countries, and have written up a very comprehensive report under the guidance of Mervyn King of King Commission claim, and a lot of that is in the presidential guidelines, which have simply been ignored. So our view is we would like to go into all the details. You yourself are quoted in the media chairperson as saying how difficult it is to consider the full implications of such complex measures. And if I may say, it's extremely difficult and almost impossible. We have no idea, for example, of what is called the mischief principle in law. Before you want a measure, you need to be able to say, why do you want the measure? What is the problem you want to solve? There is no statement anywhere that we can find, literally hundreds of pages of documents, thousands of pages of submissions, that states what the problem is. There are imaginary people called Tondi who have imaginary problems, and these imaginary problems. I'm glad at the time, see, because when I saw so Tondi, they picked on you, and they were very insulting to you, because what they said to whoever this Tondi was, they portrayed Tondi as being an extraordinarily stupid person. So this hypothetical, imaginary, very stupid person she actually had no idea what she was doing. That's not your problem. And all of her probably imaginary, fictitious problems were actually simple common law problems that didn't need any legislation whatsoever. So to the extent we have any idea of a problem, it is a fictitious problem and it's not actually a problem for which legislation is needed. So what you would do, if I could just quickly summarize what a socio-economic impact assessment does, and they're conducted in most countries of the world now. They are normal around the world. They have different names in different countries. We had a socio-economic impact assessment called the cost-benefit analysis for the phase bill, which in fact was itself a copy of the British one, which failed in Britain and failed in South Africa by their own criteria. This isn't us saying it failed. They themselves said what the consequence would be, and the consequence was the opposite. In other words, there would be reduced in sterling, in fact there was increase in sterling. That there would be close to zero costs, in fact there were massive costs, billions of rand. So Britain failed, we failed, and both. Now we're following the failed model we followed in them trying to fix their failure. Yes. And
the most thing is the UK.
Yes. Now in Britain, if I might add, in Britain a regulatory impact assessment is a bigotry. The cabinet has a regulatory impact assessment committee, and there is no reference anywhere to what the British regulatory impact assessment says. No one has apparently even bothered to read it. And so if we can say that this is a bigotry in Britain, this is a bigotry according to this department's own minister, and the department has ignored their minister. So we would say to you, without going into detail, which we would, but let's say we think that the, with great respect to you, this portfolio what this committee should say to the department is go away and come back, take back the bill and give us the impact assessment your own minister says is required.
May I conclude with just one or two sentences? You have our empathy. You are settled with a huge responsibility, which is to ensure that we have a financial services sector with us that has to be globally competitive. To some extent that it becomes adaptive to potential foreign investors throughout the world. This is the responsibility that we perceive as being of utmost importance for the committee. So this is where our inputs are coming from. We kindly urge you to take up step on this. Again, it's not in an arrogant manner, but it is indeed stating this is what needs to happen. We need to have a financial sector that's going to come about as a result of making it easier for people to go into business, reduce the cost of doing business. We hear this coming from Parliament from time to time. We've been saying this, pushing it over the years, but we have yet to see this in the context of this bill, or any other bill pertaining to the financial sector, which I have said is a matter of the economy, that should be created by the body. So we urge you to really, really think seriously. This hand was suggesting the bill to a rigorous, very rigorous, rigorous social economic assessment. Thank you,
Chair. Thank you very much.
think you might sit here all the time. Okay, I was in the South African Reserve Bank. So there in the team.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you, Committee, for affording us the opportunity to present to you today. I'm joined by my colleague, Mr. Rebecca Kablana, who is the Head of Policy Support within the Reserve Bank in the area of bank supervision and the prevention of banking. Chair, we have circulated the presentation. In the interest of time, I'm going to cover three broad issues. The first is financial stability and the role of the Reserve Bank in playing a key role in ensuring financial stability for the country. The second is a little bit of governance issues within the Prudential Authority. And the third is what does conglomerate supervision mean for us and some of the challenges that we face and how we plan to approach that. So, Chair, if I use the presentation as a guide, my apologies for not numbering it, but I'm going to skip straight to slide 6 to talk a bit about the financial stability mandate up front. The key lesson from the financial crisis was that price stability was not a sufficient condition for financial stability. You, in low inflation environments, you can still get financial stability. The Minister of Finance, I think it was in February 2010, formally wrote to the Reserve Bank to give the Reserve Bank a primary responsibility in the area of financial stability. Financial stability cannot be achieved solely by a central bank. Financial stability has to be achieved more broadly by policymakers, by financial market actors, by financial institutions, etc. And so the philosophy in the bill around financial stability is as follows. A, it gives the Reserve Bank a key role to play in achieving financial stability. B, it requires the Minister of Finance to set a framework within which the Reserve Bank has to play that role. The third point is that it sets up something called the Financial Stability Oversight Committee, which is a committee of the Reserve Bank, Treasury, regulators, etc. But it, in some ways, institutionalizes cooperation and collaboration amongst regulators. It is, and this, I think, is a very important and innovative approach to achieving financial stability. It can only be achieved if there is proper cooperation and collaboration amongst regulators. We don't want to use the word force, but in some ways to still force the regulators to cooperate in the interest of financial stability and give each regulator, in particular the Reserve Bank, a clear role to play in this regard. And I think it's important for the committee to understand the way in which financial stability is being approached. There are macroprudential elements of financial stability, and that is looking at the system as a whole, looking at the forest, if I use that analogy, and what could potentially threaten the forest, what diseases are out there, are there landslides waiting in the midst, what could potentially threaten the forest. And then the second area is around microprudential supervision and the prudential supervision of individual financial institutions. In a country such as South Africa, where you have relatively concentrated financial markets, it is critically important that especially the major significant financial institutions are regulated soundly and that there is appropriate steps put in place in case of a problem, in case any of these financial institutions fail. Chair, I would also say that these macroprudential regulations around financial stability are relatively new globally. In many ways, they are untested. Some countries have experimented with things like loan-to-value ratios in the housing market to achieve a degree of financial stability.
Loan-to-value
ratios.
We are not financially equipped. Not the MPs in Britain, but the MPs in the United States. So simplify the MPs in Britain.
My apologies, Chair. When a bank gives a loan, if you ask for 100 grand mortgage and the house is worth 100 grand, if they give you a 100 grand loan, that ratio, that loan is 100 grand of the value of the house. If they give you a 60 grand loan, then it's a lower loan-to-value ratio. And loan-to-value ratios have been used internationally when authorities were concerned that, for example, the housing market was rising too fast. So there was a financial stability risk. There was no inflation, so you wouldn't increase interest rates in this context. And in particular, countries have used this to depress housing bubbles, for example. It's a tool that authorities have used in the toolbox to achieve a financial stability mandate in addition to broader price stability mandates. That's an example of a tool. We have prudential regulations on institutional investors limiting the amount of money that they can invest abroad. Those are similar regulations that we think will help to maintain financial stability in Africa. We have prudential regulations on the banks. We prevent the banks from taking foreign currency debt that is not theirs. In other words, Standard Bank cannot go and raise dollar finance abroad and then come to the local market and then the brand without taking adequate cover, because that will increase the risk to our financial sector. So those are macro-prudential regulations that we have insisted. And the Financial Stability Oversight Committee has a key role to play in the implementation of those macro-prudential regulations. So the first role of the Financial Stability Oversight Committee is coordination and collaboration amongst regulators, forces them to share information, forces them to cooperate, to consult each other, and to be sensitive to each other when they take particular actions with the financial stability lens on. The second is to act or to implement macro-prudential regulations. There's also a critical role to play in resolution. If a bank is in trouble or a financial institution is in trouble, the Financial Stability Committee plays that role too. In broad terms, the financial stability role that the Reserve Bank leads, but is not the only role player. This is, you need policy coordination within government, you need coherence in economic policies, you need coherence across ministries and departments, and you need all regulators acting in concert to achieve that financial stability mandate. Chair, I want to touch briefly on some of the governance arrangements within the Reserve Bank. It is proposed in the bill that the Prudential Authority will be part of the South African Reserve Bank and will be subject to the governance, audit, risk, etc., oversight of the Reserve Bank. The proposal in the bill is that a deputy governor be appointed as CEO of the Prudential Authority by the governor in consultation with the Minister of Finance. And Minister of Finance certainly has a fair role to play in that regard. The proposed governance structure is that there will be a prudential committee, prudential authority governance regulation. That's the side. So there's a prudential committee that consists of four governors in the Reserve Bank. Below that, you've got the CEO of the Prudential Authority, which is a deputy governor. And below that, we've got four departments in the Prudential Authority. Two front office departments, so frontline supervision, responsible for regulating, supervising the banks and the insurance companies. Insurance supervision will move into the Reserve Bank. There's about 60-odd people who presently do Prudential supervision within the FSB, Financial Services Board, that will move into the Reserve Bank. And there are two back office departments, one that deals with risk support and one that deals with policy statistics and supporting industry. The finances of the Prudential Authority will be managed by the Reserve Bank, but a separate account will be presented for the Prudential Authority, because the Prudential Authority will be funded in part by levies, and there's a separate law that deals with the levies, and in part by the current way in which the Reserve Bank is funded. I guess to consider it. Chair, if I can move quickly into the third area that I want to talk about, and that's, what is conglomerate supervision mean for us? This is new, both in the South African context and globally. We do not want the Prudential Authority to be the sum of the two parts, banking supervision and insurance supervision. We want to move towards a new approach of regulating or supervising conglomerates. And there are several reasons for that. One is that there are risks within a conglomerate that might arise that would not necessarily be seen by either entity. So for example, if there's a large conglomerate that has a bank and an insurance company, they both might hold the debt of a particular public utility. And so you won't be able to see these risks unless you take a conglomerate view. There might be intra-company loans, there might be intra-company insurance policies, would have to be looked at from a conglomerate perspective. This will be new for the Reserve Bank, and will be new for the financial sector in South Africa. Almost all the major financial institutions are conglomerates, bank assurance type models, but each model is different. The model with Old Mutual, Net Bank versus the Standard Bank, Liberty are different. CSG, Capitec Group is different. I mean, the post provides the Prudential Authority with the power to draw boxes around specific entities for the purposes of controlled supervision. And we welcome this power because it will give us, in some ways, a discretion to see where the risks are and to regulate at the appropriate level. You don't want to be able to supervise at levels that are outside of the financial sector, but you certainly want to ensure that you have the broadest possible capturing of risk in the financial sector. And that is going to be a new approach. Some of the new regulatory approaches that we've also talked about is forward-looking, risk-based. It essentially means that we're not going to ask for the same data from all companies and go through this in the tick box process. We're going to look at the key risks. Today the key risk may be cyber security from cyber attacks. Tomorrow the key risk may be unsecured lending. Another day a key risk may be the threat of climate change to the insurance industry. And it's absolutely important for us to be able to identify the risks and to supervise the insurance and banking sector appropriately to take account of those risks and to take a forward-looking approach to regulation. So here in summary, that's my submission. This won't be the first and only interaction with the community. We will have in future, but I thought those were the three important issues that I highlight today.
Thank you very much. And the financial
thanks very much, Chair. And first of all, apologies from Hubei TV, the executive officer of the FCC wasn't able to make it today. But hopefully everyone has the presentation, which I'll run through quite quickly. So, first of all, just to remind everyone around Twin Peaks and the essence of it being that it's a move away from financial regulatory architecture structures along what was previously industry silo. We had an insurance division, a retirement funds division, etc., within the SSC, to one that structures along the lines of objectives. So in particular, market conduct regulation and prudential regulation. And you know, there's been questions around rationale and so on, and I think, as listed there, clearly what has arisen from is lessons from the global financial crisis. But I think it's important to highlight that the Twin Peaks has been judged particularly relevant to South Africa for a couple of reasons. In particular, as Graham flagged, that we are a financial sector that is predominantly through financial conglomerates, where banks and insurance companies are in the same group. It's also important because this means there needs to be a particular focus on financial stability because of this high level of interconnectedness. And most importantly, I guess, from a financial sector conduct authority perspective, is that Twin Peaks allow for a much more dedicated focus on market conduct. And currently, market conduct is done by the SSD and other regulators like National Credit Regulator. But within the SSD, there's always this trade-off between doing both prudential and conduct function within one regulator. This allows for a much more dedicated focus on conduct issues, particularly because market conduct regulation is a more emerging form of regulation in many countries around the world. The second slide is just a visual representation to remind everyone what we mean by the peak. And in particular to highlight that for the FSCA, the Financial Sector Commerce Authority, we have the three key mandates listed there. So first of all, it's conduct of business, which is essentially around how financial services firms treat their customers. Secondly, it's around the world like the SEC and so on, which is about the integrity and efficiency of financial markets. And thirdly, an explicit financial education, financial consumer education mandate as well. What should be added there is the fourth mandate, is that it because it links to the far right hand side, is that the FSA will also have a mandate to support financial stability. So even though they mentioned financial stability as the primary responsibility of the South African Reserve Bank, there is actually responsibility on all the regulators in the system to support financial stability and work with the public. The next slide is really just included to, I guess, remind ourselves that it's already been a long journey. It's coming up to the 5-year anniversary of Twin Peaks that was first announced by the Minister of Finance in February 2011. And it's been a long process, including lots of consultation along the way, and now the third draft of the bill. Moving on to the next slide, that's in terms of the FSCA. And this is the wording taken from the draft bill itself. And it just reflects what's within the previous diagram. But to summarize, the first responsibility or mandate is around efficiency and integrity of the financial system. Secondly, is to protect financial customers by promoting fair treatment of financial customers. Thirdly, it's about providing financial customers with financial education. And lastly, assisting in maintaining financial stability. So that's going to be our guiding mandate for the FSCA and forward. Now the next slide talks about how the FSCA is expected to achieve these objectives. And I think the main point here is that there's two aspects. The first is that the scope of the mandate of the FSCA is going to be broader than the current conduct mandate of the FSB. In particular, there are additional areas that are being added. In particular, I guess the most prominent one is market conduct regulation and supervision of all banking products and services. So we heard from Barclays yesterday, they are subject to some conduct regulation in terms of A, where they provide advisory and intermediary services. But going forward, they will be subject to comprehensive conduct regulation, including things like transactional banking products. The second thing to point out is that this tricky change is not only, it's not just about changing names and moving chairs on, around, it's actually about a very fundamental change in the approach to market conduct regulation and supervision. So in other words, not only what will change, but also how market conduct regulation will be done. And I think the most important thing to flag in terms of the changes are, so first of all, a much stronger emphasis on cooperation and collaboration between regulators, as Kevin also mentioned. But also saying that the conduct regulator must have an eye to promoting sustainable competition. So that's something new. Also, an explicit mandate to support financial inclusion. And that's something we're very, very glad to see, that this is now made very explicit, that that's the role of the conduct regulator, in fact, also the prudential regulator as well. Other changes in approach is that we must also make sure that we always keep an eye on the future. So not only be happy with what we're currently doing, but also looking forward and seeing are there gaps that we need to address. Then there's other functions like collecting evidence and doing research, but also looking to this forward-looking, it's also about having an eye to whether what we're doing is having the right outcomes. So is the financial system delivering fair outcomes for customers? And this the function today, we must be constantly evaluating and assessing us, which we think is a positive thing. And lastly, formulate and implement programs for financial education. So this is the shift from the current FSC mandate, which is just to promote financial consumer education, to one where we hopefully will also be empowered to actually implement and provide some of those programs. Chair, just to point out that the bill goes on in talking about the function. It also says that the FSCA must, when it comes to the scope of its activities, make sure that it coordinates with the National Credit Regulator on the demarcation of the scope of market conduct regulation supervision with respect to credit products. It also goes on to say that the FSCA must take into account...
Wait, can I just interrupt? Just a misunderstanding. Only when stakeholders come, we expect them to stay to take questions. There's some confusion here. And the two gentlemen from the free market are taking up to leave. So we understand that they're going to say, but can I just interrupt you? Because you want to pass up to speak, right? You're going to be body, you're going to be around a lot. And love you playing the ball after now. So can we take questions, comments, contributions to the points made by the free market foundation? Yes. Any comments?
Mr. Chair, just I think that the call for economic impact that is definitely with your further discussion.
Right. Yes.
No, Chair, I just wanted him to briefly, you know, showing us what their own take of the current proposed principles. You know, so it's out of that. I understand I agree with most of the things that they've made, but one would like to hear them out more on three
aspects.
Michandi? Sure. I really appreciate the comment. And Kumar will help me because he is with me in the business. He might be more on the other with policy formulation in government. The last time I checked, National Federal Group for sports. This collective is due to fiscal overrides, and we don't necessarily do credit formulation. And the National Planning Commission has been responsible for the alignment of policies and the implementation thereof by government. Therefore, if there is a different understanding about the role of the National Credit Regulator and National Treasury in relation to this specific institution, it's the role is the purview of the National Planning Commission to iron out the role. Challenge. We at the committee were looking at fiscal oversight methodologies that need to be implemented by the National Treasury. So I want to make a suggestion to Free Market Foundation. First, they will want to engage more with the committee because it allows to be on the side when they do policy formulation, they have a lot of discussion to the public discourse on the thing. So I
believe that's the point. That's the point. You want to ask a question? Unusual, but it's a high office to make your comment. I like
that in
that
region. Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of people saying, you know, internationally, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Everyone who comes will say contrary things. So we said internationally, this is the practice, the free market foundation said. The way I understand the Free Market Foundation is, I'm not sure they believe in any regulation. So it's a light-touch approach, and if you took that approach, well, 2008 happened, how do they explain that? Which is not to say I reject the view that there should be no regulation. I think, sure, in some instances, we do have too much regulation. There's no impact assessment, etc. The difference in the financial sector is this regulation is there. It is a Basel III. There's international standards. Now, what we're trying to do is to put that in force. Yes, on market conduct, there may not be international standards as such. So it's important to isolate. You see, on an impact assessment, if we did an impact assessment on every, then I would say, if we didn't implement Basel III, what are the consequences for the economy what are the consequences on our financial institutions when they don't meet those standards? The cost can be enormous. Okay. The impact assessment would work on specific issues, because, but I think that if you look at the whole approach, I do think that there's a philosophical difference. And I'm not sure that I would stand by their international approach. It would help if they do believe, put up their hands and say, do they believe any regulation is okay? And certainly in the financial sector, the approach they take, and I've heard them on the radio as well, they sort of say, but the regulators are terrified to say they don't want to be regulated. I'm sure they heard the JFC just how strong people are. So because they're scared, they're the people who speak for the industry. I don't think that the industry would actually want them to speak for them, because with just their approach, the industry itself will feel much more exposed when they operate globally. So I'd like to know that, you know, whether they believe any regulation is in place for the financial sector, and how they explain the failures of 2008.
I'm familiar with my friend with the free market foundation, as you very critical about it. But you are not giving up alternatives, the point of what is up. You know what I mean? What else are you supposed to say for what you say? I think almost everything. Basically, how it is going to operate, isn't this really an ideological thing? We never going to agree. Surely all of us have to adapt and change to circumstances. And, you know, you might have some case. 2008, but surely it's recent, it's a trend right now. Secondly, I don't think it's reasonable to say this number, it's been 5 years. You say there are reasons enough, I think maybe they don't agree. There are reasons in the list. We don't always agree with them, but I think, you know, thirdly, I would like to suggest that what is being done, Mr. Lowell, so it's recently similar to what's happening in free market economies all over the world. It's not new. You know, it's sort of like not a socialist ratio or anything, a socialist democratic relationship. People who are bringing free market oriented, I think, on the market sector, you know, they're slightly amused at some of the bills, but you were actually having the 80s dealing with that in 2008. The other questions I have to ask, but I'm not to be able to find. So also say that we will obviously have a reply, we want to come back fine. But I think that I would like to suggest that we provide a premises for our exchange. The committee, the majority are not going to agree on that type of regulation or no regulation. I think the most of us are not pleased and understand those unbalanced free markets. A couple of political parties here and some other later. So what we ask you is, can you give us a written submission on what precisely is the point of information? What precisely are you proposing?
Thank you, Chair. That's why I'm Chair. Thanks for allowing us this opportunity to ask your questions. I propose to Leon that what I do is to take a summary issue that has been expressed, and I know that the Honorable Member, in the course of his raising some concerns previously and so on, he has touched on a number of issues, so let's just deal with some of them. Now, first of all, let's understand something about regulations. Regulations have cost implications. There's no denying that they have cost implications. And so with that in mind, we need to be very, very careful as to what sort of regulations we enact, because they might have very serious detrimental unintended consequences. That's what we would caution. And so from a free market perspective, what we advocate is that there should only be necessary and appropriate regulations in place, and always bearing in mind as to what the implications are going to be, because as I have said, regulations have cost implications. Now, very, very important. Now, there are occasions for free markets, and free markets are simply defined. First of all, free market is not an ideology. It is a spontaneous one. It is what people do when they end up owning and liking some interest. free market is defined in terms of economic trade of what is misconstrued by some circles. Different circles, it actually means that a situation where people are allowed, you know, to get into economic transactions, voluntary exchange, and where private property is protected, where there is freedom of choice, that's what defines it. And lo and behold, if you go to areas, for example, like the Haiti or some pocket of economic activity, you will find cases of a free market in operation where there are no regulations whatsoever. Some people tend to think that if there are no regulations, then you're going to get disorder. Now there's going to be confusion and so on. No, it doesn't happen like that. It doesn't. But so a real exercise very, very strongly, but when you contemplate regulation, you think very, very carefully about the implications of regulations, especially on the targeted sector of the economy. Now I'm saying it. But I think we need to have a reality check here. For a while, we used to be the biggest economy on the continent. Now we try to console ourselves by saying we are the most sophisticated economy. Having lost that number one position. Now, and this was predictable. We saw it coming. This was inevitable. It was because of the policies that were in place, especially policies pertaining to the financial services sector. And so we're losing. We're losing this sector. That's not because all of us talk about sophisticated economy. We're losing. We're losing too. We're losing to the other sub-Saharan countries. And as we said in terms of our economic performance, we're dismal. We're negative. There is a real danger of us going into a recession next quarter, next year. Real danger. And so this is where this concern is coming from. And if you look at all parts of the neighboring countries, what sort of growth rate are they calling? Mozambique 7.1. And Europe, Ethiopia 10.1% last year, the whole on average, and so on. So they
If you look at this committee, I can simply speak for the ANC. You've got brilliant thinking. We're very familiar with the argument. That's not going to help us to deal with it. Certainly, this bill is not going to be good. Okay, can I have a few questions to both of you? Mr. Rosenberg, Mr. Lee. Can you firstly accept that this bill is not going to be good? Yes. Two, is in Parliament your Parliament as much as anybody else? Also, Democrats, Marxists, anybody. You are free market here. You have a right to have a full say here. But what I'm saying to you is, can you give us in written form answers to the questions we're doing? You're not long ones, simple ones. What is your alternative? Or what do you mean by regulation and so on? And I'm going to give you, let's say another three minutes to reply to the issue raised by Sandy, by Makosi, and I think you cover to a large extent more and more.
Chair, thank you for that. I'll be as brief as I can for complex questions. Firstly, our position on regulation is there's this strange bit that free market people are not for regulation. We are for very, very strict regulation. We want very few rules and we want them ruthlessly applied. Now, if we can go to this fictitious, imaginary, stupid person, Bundy. Let's understand that the so-called problems of this Bundy, which were the fact that they can't actually give you a real problem. Now, that's important. There is no actual concrete problem that's being addressed. To the extent there is an imaginary problem, it is fully covered by common law regulations. So, it really was an extraordinary statement this committee should take into account, is that in all the hundreds of pages that have been presented to you, nowhere is there a quantified, concrete problem that is meant to be resolved by something that is not already in place.
What they came to do is
they said, what is the problem we're trying to address this moment? Let me start with a wonderful
to do. Can you give that to me? I'll give it to Mr. and Mr. Levy as well. Very nice people, that's not true.
That's good, but it's not in the public domain. We have scoured for what it is we need to be trying to solve. Now, I mean, that's the first thing you always have to ask. If you want a law, very far-reaching law is to say why. Now, let me just deal with financial crisis 2008. This is a favorite mantra that gets recycled over and over and over again. Let's understand that the financial crisis of 2008 was a banking crisis of banks and governments that held subprime mortgage derivatives promoted by the American government-sponsored enterprises, GSEs as they are called, Freddie, Fannie, Jenny, and others. So it never touched, as the Treasury itself points out, South Africa. It never actually touched most countries of the world. If you look at the World Bank drug rates, the financial crisis affected a small number of countries. They were the countries holding subprime mortgage derivatives, which were being held because they were government debts. We were slightly affected. Our old mutual was a big investor offshore, because essentially it was not a South African issue, as the Treasury points out in its submission to you. So that is not a problem we had, and therefore not a problem to be fixed. So the idea of Twin Peaks, which I was asked, is, let me just deal with that. There have always been Twin Peaks. The question is, under which authority? We're absolutely correct that the prudential regulation of banks ought to be with the Reserve Bank. That's not an issue. It historically was and should remain a simple formula. What makes you prudentially sound if you're an insurer or a bank is not complicated stuff. It's actually surprisingly simple. The big issue here, the elephant in the room, is what the FSB is trying to hold on to for itself to give it some kind of reason to be a big monster. Namely, this market complex. Nobody knows what it is. It's not an international standard. It's amorphous. It's not concrete. It's just saying, give us the power to regulate. Now, yes, I will round up, but I think this is the round of which I want to finish. US parliaments are being asked to basically pass over your lawmaking function to an amorphous secret autonomous committee. They can make laws that even you can't make. You have to follow the complex procedures in the Constitution. And this is a very complex constitutional question which should be covered. And this idea of an authority that can impose its own fines and spend the money on itself, and it is not accountable, it is not elected, and very few people in South Africa know a single member of the FSB. This is something very serious which we urge you.
Okay, you write something 2 or 3 pages. Really, what you're all talking about. Okay, over to the FSB.
I'll put my hand up at seeing what the anonymous is speaking for. thanks, Chair. Given that I've given the whole word, I do want to maybe just one quick thing, which was the question around international standards for market conduct issues. So just to share with members, there is actually the G20 has agreed on what they call basically key principles around consumer protection, which they did with the OECD, which we can share with the members. But there are international agreed standards on that. The International Association of Insurance Supervisors has ICP 18 and 19, which deal with market conduct regulatory standards as well. So just to correct any impression given that there's not existing international standards on market conduct regulation, because they certainly are. In fact, South Africa was part of developing those standards, and now they're now internationally accepted. But just going back to the presentation, I just want to flag maybe bullets 2 and 4 on the slide that I was on, because I think those are the most important ones. And bullet 2 is making a point that it's not only expanding the scope of what the conduct regulator will do. Most importantly, I come back to the point that it's a different approach to how market conduct regulation supervision will be done. In particular, if those words preemptive, outcome focused, and risk-based. And I'll come back to those in the presentation. other important one is bullet four, where it says the FSCA must perform its functions without fear, favour or prejudice. And that's essentially saying that the regulator must remain independent in performing its functions. And that's independent from influence by some industry factor or overt political interference as well. Chair, I think I'll pass quickly to the next two slides because those deal with cooperation and collaboration, which you then covered. But the main point is just to flag how much emphasis there is on this in the bill on this, and how this will become a very big part of what the FSA will have to do, because we'll have to do all of those activities in collaboration with the other regulators. Chair, I want to move to the slide that talks about the regulatory paradigm shift, because this comes back to the point around forward-looking, proactive, preemptive, etc. And I think this, in a way, addresses some of the points that were raised by the Free Market Foundation and Barclays yesterday as well. Because it's also saying, I think the Treasury and the regulators are also saying, well, we agree, we don't want to have regulation for the sake of regulation. And we agree that maybe in the past there's been too much rules-based, compliance-based approach. When we talk about a new approach, it's really about shifting to something that we call an outcomes-focused approach. So it's really the outcomes that we want to make sure are consistently demonstrated rather than compliance with rules. So when we say forward-looking, it's looking at future risks, and preemptive, it's addressing the risks before they result in poor outcomes for customers. It's outcome-focused, and that will be informed by what I think members have heard from us before, this concept of treating customers fairly, TCS. We'll talk to that more if members like. And it's good faith and proportionate, in other words, it must support financial inclusion. Chair, moving to the next slide, this is really goes into some detail around where we have these principles like forward-looking, preemptive, etc. What will that actually mean in practice on the ground? I don't think we have time to go into the details, but I included it just to show that there is already thinking ahead and planning going into how are we going to put this into practice? How are the regulation supervisory approaches and processes and procedures going to change to ensure that we move to this new outcomes-focused approach? And we can come back to that if members like. But I think one other important thing to flag on this is that when we talk about intensive intrusive, we must be checking delivery and outcomes, but we also need to make sure it's very visible enforcement if those outcomes aren't achieved. The next slide talks about activity-based focus areas, and this just shows how what will be the key areas of focus in practice for a conduct regulator. And here the point is it's focusing on each and every step in the product lifecycle. So it's from the initial step of product development all the way through marketing, advice, to post-sales service as well. I think on the right-hand side, the important messages are, as I said again, it's about testing outcomes rather than those compliance kickoff approach. Secondly, it's about rebalancing responsibilities. So it will be about increased scrutiny of the way firms develop products. And that's an important shift, I think, because in the past, the focus has been on disclosure and advice, but actually it doesn't help anyone if firms are developing poor products in the first place. So we need to be more preemptive and look at regulation at the product design phase. What's important to flag is the message is regulation is not against financial innovation, but as an insurance supervisor, I can tell you, I can definitely confirm appropriate regulation, then products do get developed that are not providing value to customers, and that can lead to bad outcomes for customers. And I think one of the misconceptions that's happened with the regulation, these regulation debates in the past, is this idea that as long as it's a disclosure to customers, then it's all going to be okay. But I think, you know, that's almost based on a fundamental economics problem, because that's kind of based on the whole rational man principle of economics, that if the person gets enough information, they will make the right decision. But now we have behavioral economics telling us that actually, by and large, people don't read policy, you know, policy contracts. You can't assume that everyone is in a position to make the right decision. And in those circumstances, it is important to look at whether things like product features and so on, and whether they are one-sided contract terms that are in place, to actually fix customers more effectively. In the last two slides, just talk about what might be the implications of this for a future FSPA. So if this is the new approach, what would it mean in practice? And very quickly, I think some of the clear implications are that it will mean a different organizational structure, because we're talking about centralizing capacity along functional lines. So instead of having an insurance division, a pension division, a pay division, it's about saying, well, this core functions that apply to all of those areas, like licensing, supervision, and enforcement, and we must have consistency across that. And we must drive efficiency in delivering those functions. So it does imply centralizing capacity and structuring the organization all along those lines. If we want to follow the judgment-based approach to supervision, it means we need the right information. So there needs to be the IT systems that support and drive efficiency. It's also importantly about skills development to drive judgment-based supervision, so there will need to be investments in training, etc., but also possible addition of specialist support to have expertise in particular areas that support supervisors. Judgment-based supervision also has to come hand-in-hand with enhanced checks and balances. So that's where the Licensed Administrative Action Committee that's in the bill become important, so that you've got the quality checks on decisions by the supervisors along the way. And lastly, robust mechanisms for consultation and cooperation that we've heard about, not only coordination with other regulators, but very strong stakeholder consultations on our standard setting powers. Then, Chair, the last slide is really just saying that in case there were concerns about level of preparedness for the change, even though there can be no assumption that anyone in the FSC, particularly in the leadership of the FSC, is going to be there when it comes to the FSCA, I think in terms of a smooth transition, it is incumbent that the FSC provide at least some initial recommendations on how the bill might be applied in practice. And so there has been an internal team within the FSC, the Regulatory Strategy Committee, that developing recommendations on the FSCA transition program, an organizational design for the FSCA, and a regulatory strategy for the FSCA that had input from independent international and local experts on these areas. And it's informed by the new regulatory approach and the extended scope of regulatory function, but also informed by stakeholder consultation. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, questions, please. My question. Brandon, Candy.
Chair, I'm not sure if it's just my reading of the way the function of FSCA packages. They seem to be coming across to me more as control rather than regulating it in an enhancing way. And I think probably maybe you may wish to, because I want to see FSCA focusing as well more on the customer And I don't think that it's coming out sharply from the way they have been summarized. That's just my observation. And that does bother me because you're also someone who should come with an antagonistic presentation of what FSCA would be doing. Because that would actually probably even fighting either those that are supposed to be regulated and those that are supposed to become benefiting from that. You understand what I'm saying? Maybe I don't know if you have considered that. I do understand that it's the new space that you are probably going towards. But I would want that maybe to be captured differently, maybe to be more, to move as much as possible, away from control. If you know what I mean, I'm not sure if I'm making myself clear.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the whole product design phase intervention point. And when will that stop? When a financial service provider essentially says we're about to sell the following new policy or product or whatever, or you foresee at an earlier stage, you know, when it's all designed, because we've designed rather than product release stage. You know, you're only waiting for innovation. And I listen to you, although I support regulation, limited regulation. It does come across the many states that are coming in the whole time. That's going to be really our production relations issue. And Mr. Chair, also, I'll come back to that economic assessment point at some point with national treasury. I don't know where it's going.
Can you comment? No. Okay.
Chair, what I'm going to say is I come basically and suggest that regional allocation share conception on any political mission and being deprived an opportunity to engage the market foundation on his own misconceptions about. I'm going to talk about the problem of this but another time. I'm just saying one ideological intention. I'm just going to talk about that one. The coincidence is that I used to be in the CTI, this is a consultant for the CTI, so it's a lot. And I look forward to engaging in the new future. Yeah. I've also asked about what the GSP is saying in relation to what some patients have been doing. It's very important to open up a space, even if we're not good workers. We should not expose giving information to experts saying we're not being adequately engaged. It's a limitation on information. So I'll leave it to the team to get that. But one of the questions I want to ask, and this, in a way, I'm directing you to the professional because it was based on the GSP's assumption that the intention to exist foreign companies listed in the jurisdiction of a particular country exempt them from that. So there's a misconception that we're actually exempting foreign owned companies who are listed in South Africa from holding a South African corruption. And we need to clear the space. Is that the intention of the policy that we are trying to communicate? And then another example of the role that international companies who might be listed in foreign countries are in the so that we can grab a post to this to that. The second one is going to relate to the 2000 role that the South African Reserve Bank is going to play on conglomerates. I understand the intention, and I'm one of the people who said, when we used the South African Reserve Bank, who said, what are the health measures that we have to make sure that we don't realize the risk that we arrive with a certain bank? So I thought this is trying to address that. But here's an issue that is being raised about mortgage derivatives. So can we find space on attending to that specific issue? And maybe when we go to market, we have clarity in terms of what we mean about identification of this key risk that we want to deal with. So it shouldn't be seen as over-regulation and being intrusive and dealing with issues of competition and so on. Because the physical structure of the market every time one government is having a is that you want to over-regulate, you want to have your competition and innovation at the expense of everything. And on the inside, there's also this responsibility that government can do to the consumers and so on. We always like to strike a balance. So, until those preconditions are verified, we will remain with this problem. Especially on this one, which is like, yes, that we there's preference for a company in Africa at the expense of the local. But a very fundamental interesting thing that I want the ethics to respond to. As who determines that as a council has, you are an internationally inclined institution in terms of the international law. Because we need international law to speak to them, to our domestic law. Because it's not only about having the necessary expertise that speaks to global requirements, but we also need expertise that speaks to local and domestic requirements. I mean, some of the I spoke long ago. Now, I'll be called it Japan. You see, we don't concentrate, when we legislate, we don't concentrate only on the domestic market. We look at the whole broad economy. So it shouldn't be looked at for a specific problem. It's the whole scope that we want to extend in this context. But JSC is making an allegation that you are going to relegate them to an independent state, clearhouse state, and they prefer to be an associated counterpart. Can you also speak to that in our responses so that we can get clarity in this context where we're going? Sir, I don't want to speak to each of my companies. I also want to make it all to all of us, both the sector and government. Sometimes the words that we utilize when one should make a policy statement speak to literally some kind of relationship that we should say, right? The manner in which the presentation was made, it was like being enticed. So that's the wording that the kind of parliamentary is about to be enticed, to be disadvantaged, and those are not, they're not going to add value to the discussion. We want to speak to the impact of the policies that we're making, leave alone other than that. If consultation was good enough, we accept that and we encourage that because that's our role. But we as politicians, we might not have the technical expertise, we care about the changes, the policy has responsibility to the place. So we need to be out to understand where you're coming from. So basically, that's my input for now because I'll have an opportunity to get other questions in terms of restriction and come back and make my own.
I think that was my thing before one because I know that you want more votes, right?
Okay.
Yeah, no. Just think first, we want to indicate to the stakeholders here that we provide political decision making, but obviously we rely on our own independent stakeholders. Like Parliament said, we have the Parliament Budget Office here, which is very good, and we also have an excellent research with a five zero. By the time January comes, we'll have now. The other thing is, I think the question international strength is based on the JSC thing and the research yesterday. There seems to be quite a big leap between the last published version of the that you had on your website and the one across the parliament. Why does some leap if that's the case, right? Anyway, I think, you know, the JSC is such an important institution, almost as you and everybody would agree with us, that what they say has to be taken very seriously. So while the bill is in Parliament, and because the constituency is arises now, I don't see why the National Committee could meet with KSD. And if any member of the committee wants to go to it, like KSD, basically, and stuff, I think it's the bill is in Parliament. But because I can't fly all over, I may have to put up in many things. If you have any other day that, you know, we can consult, I can meet your office, I would. But I don't think we should always try to meet this trade to meet them. And if you don't do it, then we will do it. And then you'll have to. Last thing, if you can find your sort of
tell the principal, which is not to say that we accept the principal, that we will disagree with him. You can go down to the team and come with us. But the question I want to put to you is why, what is the huge difference between what is performed in the Pearl and what is being done elsewhere in other countries? Country has a similar disposition, free market economies, which are maybe slightly social democratic. Let's take UK, for example, for instance, reference models which have sort of like so much of that system. I'll stop there, thank you.
Thanks. I'm going to start off, and unfortunately I do have to catch a plane, but the team is here.
Yeah.
Okay. And, yeah. Hey, look, I mean, you know, the boat is a pretty complex process, to be smiling. And, you know, when we have issues, and I'm glad the issues are raised, okay, because certainly we've had consultation. If you speak to the CEO, we get agreement. Then you leave to the lawyer. And the CEO has to manage the lawyer. Okay? I think that, and I do think the way the GAT has approached it has been quite alarming. And I'm going to take this up with the CEO. Okay? Alarming in a sense that it doesn't reflect how much agreement they eat. And lawyers sometimes fight over their words. Now, a lot of the issues we would say is that we don't disagree on the intention. So, and sometimes, let's say, and their lawyer may be right and our lawyer may be wrong. But the way it's written it is, of course we wouldn't want the foreign TCP to have any advantage over local. Of course not. Okay? There's a part of the system. I would say that legal people are reading it wrong. But look, who am I? I'm not a lawyer. Okay, we have to get the two lawyers, they have to come to an agreement. Because it may well be that the way it's written doesn't reflect what we agree with. Then the other problem is the JSC wanted the issues to be not put in regulation but in the bill. And it's not that the bill has changed, but the issue that matters are the consequential, okay? Because they then amending other acts. And yet, over that, one does need to look at, again, the wording issues. So what I'm saying is, I think there's actually a lot more agreement. There are some issues, but the JSC also needs to accept that a CPP is not just a SIPI, it's a super SIPI, okay? The JSC also needs to accept that we can't write legislation to protect their monopoly status. Okay? We don't like self-regulation. I've said to the JSC, we are going to go and deal with what's called self-regulatory organization. So, those issues, if they want to say like this so strongly, will raise all the issues. But I'm saying that we do have a better way of communicating. And I think that coming to alarm the committee in this way, I do take some exception to that. Because I think if Nicky Newton King was here, I think he would get a different approach. Okay? I don't know why there's a different approach. Because we talk. We're on the phone all the time. And as I said, these become issues of detail. I don't want to deal with one lawyer's ego over another. But certainly when the bill comes, and I agree with the lawyers, what matters is what's actually written in the law. So certainly the lawyers have to come, but they need to manage within the policy framework that we're heading in. So we certainly will continue to talk, and as you said with the bank yesterday, because in there we talk to individual banks, you know, then you deal with the industry association, you get the lowest common denominator of agreement. So we often talk to each bank separately. And yes, there's a lot of decisions to be made, and even the banks, for example, have different interpretations because you're dealing with armies of lawyers. So I don't think the committee should be surprised that there are differences, and yes, the JSC is important, but the way we write the law, we also can't protect certain territories, a certain sort of, so a lot of life touch that they eat, and certainly I don't think it helps to not say, when you put in the issue of the foreign versus local CPP, when we talked with Neon Intention, the one issue then of can change, I was really hoping we could have actually got the wording right. And yet sometimes there are a few mistakes that crop in and we can certainly raise the issue so that they're actually non-issues. And it's been signaled, but we couldn't reach agreement. Our technical tools couldn't reach agreement on the wording. So let me, I'll stop there just on the various issues. I think just on the other issues before I go that I wanted to deal with, I think that the impact assessment certainly, it's easier said than done. I think it helps to say what aspect do we want an impact assessment. Because in a sense, there are impact assessments done about whether you do Basel III or Basel I. Whether, if you look at the scan, there's been an impact assessment done. But you can do it in part. The FIT and then also. Certainly the money, the market conduct, one needs to look at that. And I think, as we said yesterday, there can be overreach and so on. And again, some of it is, maybe on the intention of the wording difference. So some people will feel a Sandy doesn't exist, that there's no problems with the insurance sector. So if you look at some of the objections from the Free Market Foundation, the other spokesperson, sort of don't like the fact that the conduct regulator can override what they consider legal contracts between an insurance company and the policyholder. Well, we say we can, if it doesn't meet certain minimum standards, because there is asymmetry of power, especially in the financial sector, and that's why you've got to protect customers. So Sandy has a hell of a lot of problems. I'd like Mr. Lowe to know, if he's not here.
Any of the appointments that
unlike Satan. Therefore, we will continue engagement. We have asked them, do not exclude associate carrying out these duties. It's not a question of legal interpretation. They chose to engage with us. They chose to inform us in August. It's too late. This law has already been to the state advisors for law, for approval. You must make your comments to Parliament. We were forced to come here, and we were forced to make these decisions. Those will not help us. I will take my financial life in hand. I'm in charge of my supervising so here. More importantly, it's important for the Parliament and the policymakers here to know what are they going to approve and what will the implications be. I invite you to give you the assessments about what will happen if they can do this. What will happen if they can foreign count parties from the license? What will happen if the DMA will be parties? Let them come and say what those assessments are. Let them provide you with comments of the market on those. There are none because there were no consultations. Those are what we can stand by.
Well, I think you made your point there. You're there now.
We will then start to your consensus and then if I can't go for it quickly, we've got 4 minutes left.
The CCP, JCP has been recognized as CCP in terms of the Committee for Payments System, CCPSFI-NOSCO, and also in terms of the European Commission in place of being recognized as qualified as being qualified by international regulators based on international standards. We have qualified as associate carer, therefore, as hearing us about to this county, we qualify and we meet those extremely international
requirements. Basically, what's the difference between the bill internationally? I mean, the UK bill and other countries.
For the UK administration?
Yeah. What is here in the bill?
The
UK finance bill.
Well, in other smaller jurisdictions like Australia, the exemption actually only applicable between the United States and the European. In smaller jurisdictions such as Japan and Australia, because they have more financial issues, detailed conditions, events are never appropriate for that if you conduct this locally with that local license. Secondly, there is no we need to have designated designated committee to combat market abuse and financial crime. That's also not in this law appropriately dealt with. And thirdly, it's not prescriptive internationally. What is the nature? You look at the CPSS recommendation for central counterparties to qualify the central counterparties. Nobody here has to say what is the nature of the business and that independent associated in terms of crime. What it says, what must you do?
But you're going to get a different word in the behavior because it's quite a complex area and you can engage with it. But I guess it's good. And Kuvin, do you want to say something? Basically, Kuvin, you basically think about the politics. You haven't raised any issues about your concerns about the bill. So, you know, I'm not sure if you're getting questions, but you can give us some comments for about a minute. Go for it, please. Will everyone contact you?
Thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity. It was a very important question from the honourable member, so thanks very much for that. It was about just to get the impression that it continues to be an adversarial relationship between the regulator and the regulator.
Well,
that can't be good. Honourable member McCauley's question.
Oh,
So it's important because I didn't really deal very fully with it in the presentation about what does this shift to an outcomes based approach under TBS mean. And it's a very important shift because in the past, the conduct regulation described as a bit of a bereavement. You hang around and you wait for somebody to do something wrong and it slaps them. With CCF, what we're saying is it must move a little bit more into the face of almost like a doctor, a medical practitioner. You look for where the risk of bad treatment or bad health might be, and you try and work with institutions to make sure that they improve their health, so sort of preventive medicine type approach. Because what CBF is saying is that the primary responsibility for delivering good outcomes to customers must be on the financial services firms themselves. They have the board and senior management of financial institutions have to take that responsibility. If they're customers, they have to treat them fairly. It's not the regulator's job to be the first line of defense
and making sure that they, you know, we copy everywhere at the same time, making sure things are done properly. It must be the boards of directors and senior management who must make sure that the culture and governance in those firms is right, but that they treat the customers at every step of their relationship with those customers. And that changes the relationship from us versus them to one where the regulator makes it clear what we see as the key outcome, and we say, you firms go and make sure you deliver on those outcomes, and you show us how you've delivered consistently on those outcomes. So we're particularly pleased when they're ones that actually work with firms to understand how they apply their judgment to deliver those outcomes, and then we apply our judgment to whether they made the right call on that. And the focus really is on the customer, because as you said, that's the ultimate thing. So we define outcomes according to what we see as the outcome that should be delivered for customers. So a customer must get products that are appropriate for them. They must get the right kind of advice. They must get good after-sales service. So the outcomes are all constructed to talk about the customer and what the customer should expect when they deal with financial services firm. And then our whole market conduct framework becomes what has the firm done to make sure that they deliver those good customer outcomes. So it's a very different change from the previous adversarial policeman type role, and so I'm very glad the question came up actually.
But it doesn't mean you have to avoid it.
Yeah, exactly.
The two
go hand in hand. Because if you work with them and you've explained to them what these outcomes are that we expect of them, and we work with them to say tell us how you're going to deliver it, if they don't listen to that and they still go ahead and treat customers daily, then that's double reason to kick off them hard. So it's this concept of pre-warn and, you know, pre-advise, and we were following actually a very consultative approach with industry to identify what are these big risks to customer outcomes. And they must be clear on what we expect them to do, but if they still don't do it, then there will be important action to contact.
You know, there's a strong current view among certain people that up till now, the focus has mainly been on industry, and protecting industry almost against the consumer, the customer, and the SMEs. But we will find the time to get a chance to reply to that. Having said that, so you were saying a quick reply to that.
The Honourable Member from the VA around the product.
Brandon.
Honourable Member Brandon. I just want to make it clear, so we're not saying that the default is product fee approval. It's the job of the regulator can't be to approve every single product.
Yeah.
It's back to this concept that we say, firms, you must make sure that you develop products that are going to actually deliver value to customers.
Yes.
And the board and senior management and the control functions in the firm must all be focused on signing off that the products they develop are appropriate. So we deal with the risks at source. Our job doesn't become to check and approve products. It's their job to make sure they develop good value product, and if they don't, then it's clear they're consistent and they're poor outcomes of the customers, then we go back and say, well, why didn't you do your job properly?
Yeah. You were saying the picture before we round up, any comment on any issue that has been asked in the last hour and a half?
My chair is honourable Price is absolutely correct. The African bank story is one of the reasons why we go into the government.
Thank you all. President, you have to be.
The thing is that at the moment there's a brief response from what I understand of the basic internal department and the FSB, the actual committee actually sits in there, I think the FSB address. Now, I'm actually concerned.
I'm not here to tell you. Okay.
If I'm reading the banking provision correctly, because the FSB abolished the entire, all the people that work at the JSC, all the employees are remarkably used to the money. effectively won't have any authority anymore. Because Alderman can't tell the citizens to say, oh, you then can't turn the people over.
No, but sorry, because JC staff reports market use to the directors of market use who are conscious of the issue, but if the FSB is currently going to a public committee in exchange, we report on it that very specific committee and the director and its functions, the investigator functions of that committee, the FSB, the DFA is being abolished, not the JC employees.
So then, Mr. Chair, I don't follow the concerns the JCO raised because the people are staying in the FSB. They'll still be able to report the abuse to this department within the new supreme regulator, should we say. So maybe they can just maybe say that it's a little more clear for me to understand them.
The reason for that is that the DFA is not an administrative body. If you look at our submissions in paragraph 5, it doesn't make enforcement decisions. It considers matters that have brought to the attention of the direct market abuse and the result of the work and the claim taken by that department in relation to those matters. So it does not have, because it is the investigators of this that investigates and get all information together. And it has a good understanding of the abuse. The provisions of the Act, they play an important value role that supports the process. That investigative process, as I've called it in my thinking, that you have an enforcement committee without the benefit of those people that have intimate knowledge of market abuse that has done that appropriate investigation and has no recognition. That is a gap. Now, that's what I can't, I don't want to read every word from this, my submission is for November. But if you want us to expand on paragraph 5, it was about the nature of the very specific role that the DNA played in the combating of this market.
Okay, thank you very much.
To brief point to that, I mean, one thing we has been asked, many things we have asked, one thing that is that the current DNA is comprised only of industry members, so the concern clearly has is that it seems to be not
Firstly, I want to thank the public stakeholders. You understand the price situation as well, but we managed reasonably okay. We will come back to you in some form or another. Certainly, we need to inform them via a message to the call that when National Service comes to the party, it's critical. And you can speak again. We will have a bigger block of time. Secondly, we have a report just to the left of the financial sector regulation board. But I'm going to communicate to the DDG that we're not going to be rushing. That is that's probably too difficult and challenging and complex for that. So we're going to go through it carefully. And because of how we where it is, we're unable to fish it safe. Now, this means that when we come back, we'll finish the close up close. But we've done most of it. People are making inputs on the bill as a whole, right? So that's how we understand it. So we'll fix that in the time. Members, this is our last 50 meeting for the year. And I thank you all, and if you want to well, the JC will host us because they're very upset with this bill, so they want to come and lobby us, so we can take it there. I have a recapping for us, we're already on the phone. We're listening to that, didn't somebody just have a chat here? Okay, that's it for the team. I thank you all, I wish you well on the new year, and I hope members to note that the 2016 local government election, we will see the ANC here in full force, hopefully the past year, look at the opposition party, this one here in Brandon. Yeah.